for just one day. I want to break all regulations, because we all go the same way, and we all pass the same stations. For just one day, I want to feel totally free. No responsibilities, just everything is okay. No desires, just surviving is the key. Surviving is the key. Surviving is the key. Surviving is the key. Surviving is the key.
Toxic compounds in our tissue at any moment. A baby born in Birmingham or Boston or Bend, Oregon this morning has 287 chemical compounds in her tissue.
The reality is that we've gone so far out on a limb that it's going to be a difficult process, Justin. We have some hard times ahead of us.
It's not this individual hot evil we continue to concentrate on, despite the real suffering it causes, but rather a cold evil.
And unless we begin to make efforts now to reinforce our satellites and power grid, we could have something maybe 10 times bigger than Katrina. We're talking about the loss of all electricity and all satellite activity. We'd be thrown 100 years back into the past.
I want to ignore a senseless fate. Colors are victorious over the gray. Start to get controlled by the state. For just one day, I want to forget the value of money and gold. I want to live life my way and lose my inhibition threshold.
About a potential Katrina from outer space. 12, we do expect, perhaps, another big one.
We are facing a kind of wall here.
Short circuit all the transformers and blow out the satellites and fry the communications grid. Then you're talking about knocking out the United States for months before we can get enough rescue crews and repairmen. Handle not just one city, but hundreds of cities around the United States.
This is what we have to expect. Unemployment, homelessness, bank failures, hunger, crime, political instability, and international conflict.
So the Earth shifted 3 inches as a consequence of that 8.8 earthquake. The day is no longer 24 hours. It's been shortened by 1 microsecond.
What's going on here is nothing less than the fruit being born of a diabolic but truly magnificently orchestrated.
Yes. Magnificently orchestrated and diabolic takeover of, and by the way, he's referring to GMOs with that. Uh-huh. He's talking about certain corporations, some that begin with the letter M, like Monsanto, and some of the stuff that they've been doing in taking over the entire food supply of the world so that they can make all of it genetically modified and belong to them. So that's one of the pieces that we deal with here. So welcome to Shift Shapers, Pole Reversal Radio, here on KBBF FM 89.1. And we're starting off this first hour, by the way, for those of you who are on the road, it's 4:05. And we are starting out this first hour talking about transition. And by the way, in our second hour, we will also be talking about transition. And what is transition? So for anyone who does not have that part of it down, we have somebody with us who is going to talk about just what transition is. I have in the studio with me Scott McCune, who is actually, you can give me a title in a moment here, but I've interviewed Scott before. He was one of the people who had originated a transition town in Sebastopol, California, which is in Sonoma County. And there may be some, since we reach a 10 to 12 county radius here with KBBF, I've brought in Scott to talk about not only what transition is up to and in the various areas of our coverage, but nationally And also there is a class, a course coming up, a workshop within a couple of weeks to really start training communities on how to start transition themselves. I'm going to turn this over to you, Scott, so you can explain what transition is. Scott McCune, thanks for joining us here.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dan. It's a privilege to be here. Well, for those who don't know, the transition movement is a movement that started in the UK about, 6 years ago. A gentleman named Rob Hopkins was a permaculture teacher, and he had a class in Ireland that he worked his whole class through a program to figure out what if all of a sudden we didn't have the amount of cheap fossil fuel that we normally have, what would happen to that town? And they came up with a class project about building some resilience into their little community to deal with the lack of fossil fuel. And to his surprise, the little town in Ireland actually adopted the plan as their formal plan. Mm. And he got inspired by this, and he went back to his native country of England, and he went to a town called Totnes in southern England, and he started organizing his little town around that idea that how would we become less dependent on fossil fuel? And the two driving factors he was looking at was two things, peak oil and climate change.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to make sure that people understand. First of all, peak oil is, that means we've already gone past the peak oil. What that means is there is a point where you have gotten to really the last point of new production and new discovery, and it starts to be on a decline after that. And
yes,
that's what peak oil is. And what it literally means is how to deal with that phase where you start running out.
Yes, and the misconception oftentimes is that we're going to run out of oil, and we're never really going to run completely out of oil.
Right.
And that's oftentimes what gets confused.
Right.
Really, back in the day, it was Jed Clampett and his little shotgun would shoot in the ground, up from the ground would become a bubbling crude, right?
Right.
So that's how oil used to be. It used to gusher out like that. And but, for instance, since the 1960s, we've stopped discovering as much oil as we were before. Now, we peaked out in the discovery in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And now all that easy stuff is gone.
Right.
And we're going deeper out into the ocean. We saw what happened there with the deep water. We're going up into crazy places, talking about the pristine North Slope of Alaska and drilling places like that, which if we drilled there would be just a little bit of oil to get us by for a little while.
Yeah, like a day or two's supply for the world.
Something like that, small amount. And now we're doing fracking for natural gas, and we're stripping out the entire tundra of Canada to squeeze oil out of those rocks, the tar sands out there. Mm-hmm. And so the easy oil is gone. It's getting harder and harder. There's a few places where some easy oil is left. Saudi Arabia, for example. There's a few big oil fields, the Ghawar oil field, for instance, in Saudi Arabia, which is just massively gigantic. And we really don't know, though, how much they have left in that oil field.
And they won't tell us either.
They won't tell us, right? So fundamentally, the entire American way of life depends on what's going on over a couple of big oil fields in over there, and we have no idea what's actually happening there. So people who know this, and there are people who know this, get a little bit, there's a lot going on behind the scenes that just isn't talked about in the mainstream press, and it's not talked about in the political world.
No.
This discussion just simply isn't happening. And then every once in a while, there'll be some press releases about, we found oil. Okay, we're all great for another 100 years. You know, oftentimes those are press releases put out by oil drilling companies wanting to get stock bumps and so forth, and they overestimate some find they had in the deep water, which happens. And then it turns out almost always that it's not as great as what they thought that it was.
Yeah.
And
one thing that I've actually gone to, I was just feeling down, like we can't be running out. And like you said, we're not really running out. It's in fact, we'll get to the point where there's still a bunch of oil that you can't get to because it's just so expensive. But I went to one of these peak oil debunking peak oil fraud sites that try to debunk the concept of peak oil. And they're just full of just these, see, we've got all this. We've got these 80 million barrels worth in Pennsylvania. We found 80 million barrels on this slope of this and on this coast of that. And when you do the math, so I went, this is great. I feel better now. But when I went to find out, I Googled on daily consumption, global consumption of oil, and it was exactly those 80
about $80 million a barrel today.
Yeah, that's it. It's like, oh, good, we found enough for 3 days. Thank you. Really reassured me, debunking site. Thanks.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and so it's getting harder to get. Clearly, we can see what they're doing with the whole the Keystone pipeline and all that. So, all right, we still have oil. It's reasonably cheap. It's actually the real cost of the oil we don't really know about. It's we don't hear about that, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the United States, the production of oil, and I'm talking, you know, collection of oil, not refined, producing it at a refinery, but the real production of crude oil peaked out around 1970. And it was predicted, and I think many of the listeners probably know about this who are aware of peak oil. But that same thing is going to happen fundamentally in a place like Saudi Arabia at some point. We just don't know when that's going to happen. It could be happening as we speak. It could be 5 years. It could be 10 years. But at some point, no matter what they do, they're not going to get out more oil, and they'll use every trick in the book. And we keep extending it
they'll
a little
bit. Detergent even.
Right, we're pumping natural gas in. We're flooding it with water and ruining water tables. Like I said, strip mining whole landscapes to squeeze every last drop. So it's not going to go away. It's going to get more expensive.
Right.
And we saw what happened in 2008 when we got to $5 a gallon prices. But what happens if we get to $10 a gallon or $15 a gallon at some point?
That will be reached.
Yeah, we don't know when this is going to happen, but it's out there on the horizon, and what's scary is that nobody's talking about that. This is not in the national conversation.
Right.
And literally every single thing in our lives is directly tied to the price of oil. If you look around in your house, wherever you are right now, listening to this, everything around you, unless you're in pure nature, is based on fossil fuel. Our clothes we wear, the food we eat is produced by fertilizers with fossil fuels. So
we eat oil.
Really, we consume it. We have found this amazing, magical substance that's absolutely fantastic energy, and we've built an entire advanced civilization on it. The entire industrial system is on this magic substance.
Yes.
And we're kind of heading towards this cliff, and nobody's talking about it.
Right.
So that's one point. That's one part of this whole transition thing. And the other part is climate change.
Yes.
Which says, even if we did find enough for 100 years of oil, we do have a significant amount of natural gas. There are fuels that we are finding, but oil itself, especially in the transportation sector, is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Even if we were to find another Saudi Arabia all of a sudden, or several Saudi Arabias, look what we're doing to the environment in terms of the atmosphere and the CO2 burning. And imagine China, folks in China now wanting to get the things we have and drive around in cars. And we love our cars. I love my car. And, of course, people in China want to have what I have, what we have.
Right.
And I don't blame them.
For the record, I got to the studio in a car.
And I don't blame them. Of course they would. Of course I would. But really, when you kind of do the math and figure that out, what is that really doing in the atmosphere? And if you do actually believe science... You would.
That's science. The science that scientists.
Yeah, the
give
scientist
us.
Thing.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, not the Oklahoma senator guy science.
The actual guys with the white lab coats that do studies and things.
That's right.
If you believe those guys, and they're unanimous, nothing's unanimous, but in terms of science terms, it's unanimous. They all agree that we're pumping all the CO2 in the atmosphere, and it's causing some very serious problems. We're seeing that right now in Europe.
Yes, we are.
Literally, you can have, with poles changing and ice caps, you could even see things shifting, such as the Gulf Stream. I mean, some horrific things could happen, and there's very brilliant people, way smarter than me, that are projecting out things, and I'm trusting them, their knowledge, more than I'm trusting a politician.
And I'm going to inject a couple of things here, because we've mentioned a few concepts that I'll just throw out here. One is the Gulf Stream. It's if you've ever wondered why it is that some countries that are up on high latitudes, where some parts of the world it's really freezing cold there naturally, and some other parts of the world they're in the same latitude but they're warmer, it's because of these warming currents. And the Gulf Stream is one that comes up from the Gulf of Mexico and streams on up to Europe and keeps big portions of Europe warm. California is warmed, particularly Northern California, by what's known as the Japanese Current, which comes from tropical regions in the Pacific and comes up and warms this area. We're actually at the same latitude as New York and Pennsylvania, but they get lots of snow and we don't, unless you're up in high altitude. So I just thought I'd clarify that. And the climate change, what you mentioned there about Europe, a few months ago, Richard Heinberg was in this studio and we were talking about the same subject, and he mentioned, and talking about climate change, Wasn't it amazing that in Russia there were people dying from heat last summer? So here we look at, you're in the studio now talking about people dying from cold in Eastern Europe in the winter. In the exact same year, in the exact same span of several months, we've seen killer heat and killer cold in the same part of the world.
Well, look what's happening around here right now with our drought. You can't necessarily apply every seasonal variation to climate change, but there are patterns that emerge.
Yeah, there are.
And so those are the two driving factors here.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be burning so much fossil fuel, even if we have it. Mm-hmm. But we may not even have it anyway, so we need to figure out a plan B here.
Right.
And we don't have a plan B. Nobody's talking about a plan B, a serious plan B.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if we're lucky, we'll find the dilithium crystals or something that'll keep us all going.
Right.
You'd think if someone, someone being a conservative person might want to be conservative and really plan ahead and want to make sure that we have what we need to thrive as a society.
Oil is not only easy to burn, it's also easy to make a buck with oil. So it seems to just kind of keep on its own little stride there. Yeah, there doesn't seem to be much motivation to seriously look into other things. It may be that we're looking to have the famous miracle crystals come and solve everything. I don't know. But what you're saying, if I hear you right, is that it's going to be good for the climate and the atmosphere and pollution-wise. The quicker we can stop burning the fossil fuels, they're going to come to the point where they're very expensive anyway.
And we may not have a choice anyway.
Right, and we'll end up running out of a choice.
So either you take either one of those.
Yes.
And then I think on top of that now, since transition was, this movement was formed in the UK a few years ago, we've really seen an economic downturn that I think indicates the fragility of this economic growth system that we've been on. We've mm-hmm. seen this entire industrial growth system that we've been on, which has been stripping away the resources of the earth as we strip away Amazon forests and we mine the valuable minerals out of the earth and we dam up everything. We're taking so much as where our population is growing so hugely that how much longer can that continue? We're using up the oil, we're using up the forests, we're acidifying the oceans. You can just see the curve and where it's going.
Yeah.
And so on top of this is this economic system which is making more and more stuff. And what's interesting is you have basically the economic argument in our country is how to get back to this unsustainable growth. It's not whether we should think about a different way of having a sustainable income, is that our entire economic system depends on perpetual, everlasting growth. Mm. And once the growth slows down, we panic and everything comes to a halt. And, oh, my God, how do we get back onto the hyper growth and hyper consumption? And so we're just arguing which technique to get back to this hyper consumption. And so that's another whole layer onto the whole thing.
That is the conversation, isn't it? It isn't anything about winding down. Winding down is the fear.
That's what everyone's trying to avoid. And so, and we're all hooked into this system in one way or another. Virtually all of us.
I certainly am. For Milo.
Right. We're all we're all addicted to this system in some way.
Right.
I certainly am. I have a mortgage. We're all connected to this big system here. And it's very fragile. We're noticing now. We're seeing some cracks around the edges. And I think a lot of people are kind of sensing this, and they're wondering, well, what do we do? And then it comes to how do we respond to these things.
Right. My guest is Scott McCune, who is – can you tell me your title or your –
Well, I'm the training coordinator for Transition US, which is the national hub organization of the transition movement.
And
the big, massive office of four people.
Oh, so right.
We're really huge, yes.
From Transition Tower. Yeah, actually, Transition, you aren't going to have the tower so much once this transition occurs. And I'm going to just throw my own little definition of transition. You can do a whole lot better from your experience. But how I view transition is, for instance, when people say, when I give a talk about peak oil and climate change, the 1-2 punch, when we see both of those happening, people say, hey, wait a minute, you're done? Where's the hope? And that's when I start talking about transition. I start talking about, yes, we can actually plan for this.
Yeah.
We can plan for how we're going to be resilient. And so what I would define with transition is that transition is a way of designing communities and the way we do things and relearning things so that we develop and build a community and a lifestyle around functioning without fossil fuels.
Yeah. Is more stuff really making us happier? We have wonderful stuff. I like my stuff. I love my iPhone. Don't get me wrong. You know, I'm no great eco saint by any means. I'm as much into this having stuff as anybody else, probably more. But I do recognize that you know, this might be coming to a close sometime soon. And I think a lot of us recognize that we don't have to be on this hyper-consumption wheel to be really happy. They've done a study of people that live to be old 100 years or so, and it turns out things like having dinner parties and having food around people you love and being part of a community and feeling part of a community actually makes people really happier.
Yes.
And we live in this, we've been convinced through advertising, we've kind of been isolated. When you look at how we live, we're in our watching boxes, TV. We don't connect with our fellow community members as much as we used to. We're very tribal beings at heart, but we don't live that lifestyle. We're very isolated. And it's about what can we get to fill that need and that happiness. And it's been,
yeah.
And so I think we recognize that there is possibly another way. And that's what transition, I think, is really addressing. It's a positive vision of the future that, hey, look, we don't need to have all this stuff anyway to be happy. Let's rethink this. Maybe being more connected to community, perhaps getting to know our neighbors and our community better, growing some of our own food, those kinds of things can actually make us happier.
We're going to take a call here. Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, yes, hi. My name is Richard. Running out of fossil fuel, natural fossil fuel, is a reality. It's a known fact. So my question is, how long, more or less, do we have before we run out of these fossil fuels? And the second question is, and how realistic it is the alternative energy resources that we have, and what are actually we doing to make sure that we have alternative resources of energy, just in case we run out of the conventional energy that we use every day?
Good question, Richard.
Well, this is a scary part. We really don't know. We have places that we depend on. Saudi Arabia has the biggest oil reserve.
My answer out, yeah.
Okay. Perfect. All right. Thanks for calling in.
If you look at the list of oil reserves in the world, Saudi Arabia is at the top. And then you have a number of countries, Kuwait, Iraq, Iran. You know, these are all up there. They have the biggest known oil reserves. And they haven't found any really significant oil for a very long time that competes with any of these finds, these fields. And a lot of these places, we have no idea how much there is. So we do know that nation after nation that used to export oil has now stopped. They've become oil importers, and just one after another switches to become an oil importer rather than an exporter.
Right.
And they just tick off. And the map of what used to be the countries that exported oil, you see all these colors, the colored map, all these countries. And then you go now, and it's very shrunk down. And so this trend is there's only a few, and it's shrinking down, and they're not finding any major oil, and we don't really know. The Saudi Arabians aren't telling us really what they have, and so that's this part of it is we simply don't know when we're going to be running out.
And if I understand what you said before, the trend is not that, and the concern isn't so much of having none.
That's
the
right.
Concern is that what the price is going to keep being. My understanding from what someone, an economist, said is that that tar sands oil. The only reason why that tar sands oil is profitable is because oil is right now at $100 a barrel, and it's going to go up to $200 a barrel, and they're planning on that, and that's why they expect to make a lot of money on it.
And that actually gets to the gentleman's other question is the alternatives. Part of the I don't know if it's a problem, but because we have a free market system, there's good and bad in that. The bad part about that is that investments in alternatives depend on the price of oil. If they say building certain kinds of solar panels or wind kinds of technologies were extremely profitable, then we would have a lot more investment in that than we have. But if we have high gas prices, guess what? We're going to have that kind of investment. And so we haven't had the alternative, but if prices go up, we will start seeing that development.
And that's the old necessity is the mother of invention kind of thing, where See, I remember the 70s, and I remember that the lines at the gas pumps and the gas prices going up all the time, and that the White House suddenly had solar collectors on top to heat up the water and help reduce the amount and the cost of the energy. We're talking to Scott McCune with Transition US, and we're talking about, what are we going to do as that price of oil, the supply diminishes, which is really evident, and the price keeps going up. What are communities going to do to redesign themselves? And we're going to spend this second half hour going into what is actually being done. What are these transition groups being done? How do they get formed, and how do they get trained to be able to take over as a community and be ready to be rolling and at a running start once oil has gotten priced out of control?
Yeah, well, I think we have all realized at this point that we can't really rely on government to bail us out, I think, of these problems. And so I think citizens are realizing that it's up to us to really band together and solve our own problems at a local level. We're going to rely on the federal government to solve all these problems. We're going to be waiting a very long time.
Yeah.
So the idea is we talked in the first half hour about the context of this problem. We have peak oil, we have climate change, we really shouldn't be as dependent on fossil fuel, and if the price goes up, it affects the economy, and the entire economy tanks, and we're all feeling the effects. We all go down with that. So
even
how do we
food
have
supply, everything?
Right. And so the idea is to build this resilience into our communities and our lives so that when this happens, should this happen, that we can still have a high quality of life. We have the things we need, food, shelter, clothing, the things we need to provide for ourselves, and we have the happiness that we need, that we want and need from our for being a part of a community. So having that conversation in advance rather than waiting for it to hit, I think, is what transition is really all about. Because we know these things are on the horizon.
Yeah.
We all, a lot of us sense that we're kind of heading for some trouble, that something has to shift, something has to be different. But the conversation hasn't really started so much. It's a lot of blame right now in the political discussion, and
right.
But not a community conversation about how do we become more resilient,
right.
And less dependent on fossil fuel, and more localized, really.
Right, which is really getting real.
Yeah, and you know, this stuff was not big news to our grandparents and great-grandparents back then. We all had localized economies. Food came from a certain radius around. Things were actually made here, believe it or not. We used to actually have factories that made things, and we didn't import everything from China and buy it at Walmart. There was a day before we, you know, that happened.
Right.
And we could function, let's say, within a 100-mile radius. If everything came from a 100-mile radius, we could actually kind of get by. Not in all cases, but certainly a lot more than now.
Yeah.
And so we need to maybe start thinking about going a little bit back in that direction and relocalizing our economies so
wow.
that we can be more resilient. And I don't think anybody can really argue about that. There may be disagreement about whether climate change is real, but how can you argue with having healthy local economies and having a resilient community? So it's a real common ground place where we can all meet and agree, let's build healthy, resilient communities. How do we do that? That's the conversation that the transition attempts to start in a community.
Very good, very good. And it's a pretty good bet, because even if you aren't betting on the science and being real about what you see coming, it doesn't hurt to be less about consuming and stuff and a little bit less about polluting.
That's right. And without really sacrificing
right.
our well-being, our happiness.
Right.
We don't have to give these things up to give up this kind of hyper-consumption we've been on. I think perhaps if we didn't have to commute so far, that wouldn't hurt, I think, for folks. Now, no, this is a long-term thing. This is not something that's going to happen overnight. By no means can we wave a magic wand and all of a sudden we're all not commuting. This is a very difficult thing to do.
So what are some things that are being done in the North Bay, north of San Francisco, the area that this station covers? Some examples of initiatives that have gotten started in communities.
Right now, in the Northern California Greater Bay Area, there's 16 transition initiatives, which is just citizens, groups of citizens that have come together and said, hey, let's start this.
Yeah.
And they're small, humble little beginnings of groups of people that get together and start different groups to start working on different areas. I come from Sebastopol. We have a transition initiative there, Transition Sebastopol. We have about 10 active working groups that are talking about issues such as energy, food, transportation, education. We have an elders group. We have a group called Reskilling Group.
People are getting retrained on the things that are going to be important.
the basic fundamental skills of life. We don't have built websites, but we don't necessarily know how to grow vegetables for ourselves.
Right.
I know my grandmother, she used to have, they had an acre of land, and they had fruit trees and vegetables, and she had canning, and she literally had a huge amount of food that she created in her basement. She sewed a lot of her own clothes, and that was just what everybody did back then. Mm. They didn't buy everything. They fixed things. Mm. And the DIY movement, for instance, I think is part of this.
Oh, do it yourself?
Well, right here locally, the Maker folks over here in O'Reilly, the idea that we don't have to buy something new all the time. We can actually repair things. So this kind of resilience, for all of us to develop these kinds of skills, to reskill ourselves, is part of what Transition is doing right now. In communities to start having these classes and again, starting this kind of thinking going.
I would think that being able to repair shoes and bicycles would be very important in an era when oil is making it difficult to operate a vehicle.
I know. I don't know about you, but I'm pretty irritated with how things break so easily. And tools and things I buy now, they're made so cheaply just to last for as long as, you know, as long as I'm just not happy enough to take it back to the store or something, and they come in all this plastic material, and it's just this piece of junk. And some of the tools I have from my grandfather are the best tools I have. They're built to last. And so it's a different thinking. Do we want a society that's making these cheap throwaway tools, more plastic stuff that just breaks, and we throw it away and buy a new one at Walmart, or do we make things that last? Not a good business model to make things that last, so we don't. But that's the problem.
But if your entire business model and your market is totally local, you don't need to be making millions of something.
Well, perhaps a perpetual growth economy, which is the only mode we know in the industrial growth system, is pedal to the metal. That's it. And God forbid we stop that.
Right.
Now, and this is a rough transition, but a lot of people look at this shifting of the global economy as the biggest issue of our lifetime. We have to make this fundamental shift from the growth of the economy. It can't last forever. There's only so much resources as the population grows. So we have to have a sustainable economy where we are not taking from the earth more than we're replenishing and re-nourishing into it.
Right.
And we can do it.
Here's what I've seen. I've spent some time with the Transition Group in Albany, which is north of Berkeley. And I am just constantly impressed with the level of activity they have there, with the level of enthusiasm and energy that they show. And this is not just college-age people. This is retirees. This is people from a vast span of age groups. They're converting lawns into farms, literally, as we speak.
Yeah.
This weekend, they will be converting some more. They have, just like in the old days when you'd have barn raisings, they have groups, teams, that go in and they'll convert lawns into farms. Do you see that happening in other places as well?
Absolutely, yeah. Get rid of your lawn, move. You know, again, this is back to the way it was. I was talking to an old gentleman who was in his 90s named Cecil Crowe, who was a 10-year-old in Sebastopol during the 1930s, and he was telling me how nobody had lawns back then.
Right.
Everybody had chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And then, by the way, when anybody moved into town, there was a block party for everybody. And they just that's the way people were. And they watched out for each other. And if they drove into Santa Rosa, they walk around and say, hey, can I pick something up when I go into town? And there's that sense of community. This is what human beings have been doing for hundreds of thousands of years. And we can do this. We don't have to just continually buy more junk from Walmart that comes from China that we just, you know, throw away. There is a different way of being that we can do.
So is anybody keeping track of how the conversions are going from, you know, lawns to farms? I mean, can anybody has a transition community or transition group say, okay, if that truck to the grocery store stops coming tomorrow, will we be able to feed this town?
That's a really good question. You know what, our backup system is 3 days worth of groceries from the Safeway store.
Right.
That's what we have right now.
That's what we have
And should any kind of disaster happen, that's what we have. But you know, the beauty of that transition is that we don't have to wait for the government to give us permission to do this. There's nobody has to tell you to do this. We can just, as citizens, start taking action ourselves. I think that if we wait for the government, it's going to be too late.
Yeah.
Right. And if we just act as ourselves, as individuals, I think that's the other thing we do. Oh, we'll change all our light bulbs. We'll get our own little supply going. But that's going to be a little bit too little. I think we need to act as communities, which might be just enough. And that's, I think, the transition movement is trying to address is how do we act as communities? We need to act as individuals. We need to act on a national level. But it's the community part that we've been missing.
I want to talk to you about how your workshop coming up at the Arlene Francis Center in Santa Rosa, you can give me the dates and times for it, but how that's designed to incubate and encourage greater and faster, I hope, transitional activity and groups in various communities. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Oh, great. Yeah, thanks for that. I'm teaching a workshop coming up on February, the weekend of the 18th and 19th. And to find out about that, you can go to transitionus.org, look up training at that as well. Also here locally, transitionsebastopol.org for folks that want to see some things going on locally. We're trying to start a transition initiative here in the town of Santa Rosa. So this training that's coming up is geared towards seeing if we can launch something here locally in Santa Rosa and get a transition initiative going.
What do you see as a potential for communities of different cultures to work together? I mean, you see Bayer Farm. There is a Latino community out in Fulton at Fulton Road and Occidental Road. One of the churches has set aside a huge tract of land that farm workers and people from the farm workers are the ones that have the most trouble feeding themselves sometimes because they earn such little money. And so I'm wondering if there's any place or consideration in the transition movement for communities such as the Latino community and the community of environmentalists and primarily Anglo communities to work together and share their knowledge and their labors.
It's a really important issue. And any serious effort in any community has to be completely inclusive.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's not going to work. And every community, when they're looking at how to become resilient, really need to take a stock of who is that community and include everyone in it. And to reach the diversity that exists, or to include the diversity that exists in each community is incredibly essential.
I would even throw this out here that we're actually transitioning now. There are people right now who need to be fed.
Yeah.
That the cost of things going up as it is is actually affecting people right now. Food pantries are running out of food. In Albany, they've been keeping the food pantry supplied. The transition group has. I'm with the training director for Transition US, and that's all about communities just ripping away from the model of constantly using fossil fuels to get around, to grow the food, to use oil for growing our food and fertilizing and spraying it with pesticides, and getting into working as a community to feed each other and to take care of each other and to provide what we need. So,
yes, well said. I think the problems that people look at, they hear about all this doom and gloom. We've all heard about the problem.
There's plenty of it.
Yeah, and it can get overwhelming after a while. I've heard too much. I don't want to hear anymore. And I have a little bit of doom fatigue, frankly, myself, and I just don't want to hear it. See another documentary of how terrible everything's going. I want to do something about it. And sometimes it's frustrating because what are we told as citizens to do to make a difference? Vote, of course, that's very important.
And go shopping.
Go shopping and write your congressman, perhaps, and change your light bulb. Or something,
right?
You know, change your right, and vote, change your light bulb, write your congressman. That's about it.
We're going to buy our way out of this.
But it becomes kind of unsatisfactory. Is that it? Is that writing my congressman? Is that the extent of what I can do to get involved? And I think people are a little bit fed up with that, and they want to come together as to be in community with each other. Part of what we try to do with Transition is make that social fabric part of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about just doing projects in the community. It's about connecting with one another. We have a kind of a funny saying, changing the world one potluck at a time, where it's about sharing food with people, getting to know people, having a sense of belonging, having a sense of place. And those are the values that really matter in the long run. Happiness, I would venture, is more about relationships than it is about stuff. So we recognize that, and to come together in some kind of movement, if it's Transition is one option, there's others, many other great, worthy, amazing groups around here that are doing fantastic work in the community. And I think we're seeing that momentum of people getting involved in community with one another. It's exciting, actually. We live in exciting times.
Really. My guest is Scott McCune, who is the training director for Transition US. And that is a pretty tall order because there are many, many transition initiatives across this country of communities, people in communities, setting things up so that we can live independently of fossil fuels and be able to feed each other and take care of each other. Just like in this song, we're all walking home together, hand in hand. That's the way to look at it. We've been talking about resilience of communities, but there's another aspect to this, which is spiritual resilience and psychological resilience as well. And you dropped that out here during the music break, Scott. So what ideas did you have on that?
Well, I know for me, when I studied these issues such as peak oil and climate change, it gets to the point of depression almost. So much is going on in the world that's not good, and it can get overwhelming on us, and sometimes we just want to shut it out and not deal with it, and sometimes it can sadden us. And so there's a personal resilience,
yes,
that we need to address, I think. And then as we look at things that get tough in the world or in our own lives, how do we help each other to have strength through that? And
what an open question that is.
Yeah, and many people, families are having their homes foreclosed, and
right,
one at a time, families are having these difficulties. And should things change radically, say, should things at some point in the future have a downturn in the economy, a lot of people will have the rugs pulled out from under them of what their dreams were. And a lot of people already have
it's
had
already
that
happened.
Happen with,
yes,
with their life savings and housing being pulled away and that kind of thing. And it's
right.
And what are you left with? And so I think to really address that and not to just sweep it under the rug, but to understand that we have to care for one another. And there's an aspect of the transition movement called heart and soul that really identifies that we're complex human beings and we have feelings, and it's not just all about what's happening out there, but it's also about what's happening in there. And it doesn't get any, you know, it's not about spiritual stuff per se or anything
right,
like that, but it's just understanding that we do have this inner side of us, and how can we build our personal resilience in the face of uncertainty.
Right.
And I think that's an important I think a lot of activist movements don't ever go there. They don't talk about that inner side that we have. But let's face it, we all have our own interior,
yes,
side of us.
And it may be that there, even right now, because there's been this rash, this epidemic of home foreclosures, people losing their homes. We say people losing their homes. That's a loss. That's like
yeah,
a death.
Yeah.
And there hasn't been much in the way of really grieving provided for that. And I think we're going into a period where assistance with grieving is going to become more important. When you just have to get ready to, like, you're going to lose that, maybe you can't put fuel in the car and you love the car, and, you know, it may seem like really simple, well, get over it, you know, but you just never know what that moment is going to be when you really need a little bit of assistance and
yeah,
tender, loving care with some grieving over that things just aren't the way they used to be.
Yeah, and a lot of our traditional institutions who do a great job in many cases, churches and
mm-hmm,
and strong families, a lot of cases these institutions are not there, or they're not in our lives, and we don't have anything to replace them when these things come up. And I think that's part of about having a strong community and coming together to feel that you're a part of a community, that people actually care about you. And that, again, we've lost that sense of community and belonging in place because we haven't had that to use it.
Yes.
We're all independent. We make, you know, make plenty of money. We can just watch arts for ourselves. We don't need anybody else, right?
Yes.
Well, when that changes, it turns out we do need other people.
Yes.
And I think that shift is happening as well, as we realize that.
And this could be a vehicle for that to actually be happening, is that need for other people gets expressed and gets put to action and use.
Well, thank you, Dan. We do have a training coming up in Santa Rosa on February 17th, 18th, and 19th. And to find out about it, you can go to www.transitionus, just the words, letters us.org, and also transitionsebastopol.org.
I want to thank you, Scott, for coming into the studio and joining me. We are looking always at ways that we can deal with the things that are facing us in our future and also to be real about it. So I definitely appreciate you coming in with that. Are there any closing thoughts you might have?
Yeah,
I
think we see the national conversation happening right now about who's going to be president, all this political stuff. And what, are we waiting for some politician to do it for us? I mean, we recognize that this is just ridiculous and it's absurd. And it's up to us. It was never about any politician doing it. It's not about the president. It's not about the Congress. It's not about any of that. It's about communities coming together and doing it for ourselves. And I think we can all agree on that. And that's where we can find common ground and solve the problems ourselves as community.
And that's where we get to become the hope for ourselves and each other. Fantastic. And so you are listening to Shift Shapers Pole Reversal Radio.